a number of years ago, I ran across this book. Paul David Tripp is big in the Christian counseling world, and he wrote a book entitled Dangerous Calling, Confronting the Unique Challenges of Pastoral Ministry. Now, I'm not up here to whine about how hard pastoral ministry is. I'm just simply stating that he recognized in traveling around, putting on conferences all over the United States and even all over the world, that pastors face very unique challenges, very unique opportunities. They sometimes possess unique authority that they can abuse or misuse or forget how to use. And he wrote this book about these unique challenges of pastoral ministry that was it was both a conviction to my own heart when I first read this and also an encouragement. Someone pointed out to me this week that on the back of this book, as there often are, there are five statements from five different pastors saying, you've got to read this book, he's on to something, this is super dangerous. And what was pointed out to me this week is three of the five names on here are no longer in ministry because they have fallen. Okay, these are the people saying, read this book, it's dangerous, you are tempted in unique ways. One last week said, I'm not even a Christian. Okay, look with me at 1 Peter 5, and this will be part charge to myself, to our own elders, and to those who would aspire to the office, to the role of elder. And part of it, he turns then at the end of this text, and you'll see it, where he turns and now addresses the whole church of like, how do you react to these people? How do you live in concert, in harmony with those that lead you? And I hope that we leave here better understanding this role, but also, you know, all of us more humble, more in prayer for each other, more supportive and encouraging of each other. Peter writes, chapter 5, verse 1, so I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you. This is the word of the Lord. I'm going to be talking this morning about servant leadership. This is the picture that Peter, just as Paul, just as Jesus Christ himself, had presented a picture that in the world, a certain kind of person tends to be the leader. They tend to be the CEO. They tend to be the president. They tend to be the quarterback, okay? In the church, he says, I'm not worried about what the world sees as worthy of leadership, because I have a different definition of who makes a good leader, and the greatest leader is the one who is the servant of all. So with this overview of servant leadership this morning, we're going to look at the mandate, the manner, the motive, the mutuality, and the mindset. And I want to note that Peter just begins here, I think of verse 1 really as Peter establishing his credentials, that before he's going to tell another group of people how they need to live their lives, he even uses the word exhort, which means I'm going to passionately, earnestly insist on something. And you could say, well, who are you, Peter, to tell us? And so he reminds them, I'm a fellow elder, number one, which is actually a really gracious way of saying he was an apostle. He wasn't just an elder. He was an eyewitness to certain things. He had walked with Jesus. So he says, as a fellow elder, a witness of the sufferings of Christ, which is interesting because, if anything, that reminds us of, well, Peter, how much of the sufferings did you really see? Because when Jesus went through his stuff, you checked out. You denied him three times. You disassociated from him. So he's reminding us of something there. And he said, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. And so he's kind of giving you his pedigree. He's giving you his qualifications to present this message. And number one, I say this is the mandate, kind of the heart of what he's saying here. If there is a central imperative, a central command to elders, first off, It's verse 2. He says, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight. Now, you notice that word flock, and that probably sounds weird to us. I don't typically stand up here and say, you know, greetings, good morning, flock, because that, you know, that indicates that you all are a bunch of sheep. But it's a beautiful metaphor. It's used all throughout the Old Testament, actually, that God's people are often referred to as a flock with shepherds. As I led off this morning in our call to worship from Ezekiel 34, God himself both rebukes elders and shepherds for how they're leading and caring for his people. And he's also saying, I will be the perfect shepherd, the lead, the chief shepherd over my people, over my flock. And this is just the idea that the church is community. There's a communal life. You're not just a sheep over here or a sheep over here, because if you have a sheep by himself, that sheep's in trouble. Sheep live a communal life, a community life together. But I want you to notice, coming back to this mandate, that first of all, he refers to the same person, the same role. He refers to them three different ways: as an elder, as a shepherd, and as an overseer, or someone who exercises oversight. And these are not three different roles, like you need to go find elders, and now you need to find a pastor, and now you need who's going to do the overseeing. It's one person who carries out kind of three, you know, if there was a Venn diagram, a big overlapping of these different roles. And, you know, the word elder, as he's later going to contrast, and those of you who are younger, the word elder, you know, generally we think of someone who's literally older chronologically. They have some years behind them. So he's using that word elder to emphasize there's a maturity, there's a wisdom that's been gained by, sure, there may be an academic portion of that, but through real world experience. That's the idea of an elder. The word shepherd, and I mean, you know what a shepherd is, someone who's literally leading and guiding and guarding, protecting, nourishing a flock of sheep. He's putting his life out there to care for a group of animals, and it's just a word picture that we say, okay, so then this is encompassing all these ideas of a pastor is going to be someone who guides and guards and cares for and makes sure that the people in his care are nourished through the word of God. And then the overseer, it's a more visionary word of I'm looking ahead and I'm looking over, and there's that same idea then of that responsibility to look ahead and to look over and to care for. But what I want you to note is that at the heart of those three words, shepherd is the imperative. He's saying, you go and pastor these people. You go and anything that you would expect to see a shepherd do for his sheep, that is the central mandate of what God calls church shepherds, church elders to do. And I want you to note in that word that shepherding is active. I mean, shepherding just assumes that you elders are going to be interacting with people. You're going to know people in the way that a shepherd knows the individual idiosyncrasies of his own sheep. Like, this one's more prone to wander off and do stupid things. That's okay for you to know that about different people. This one's more prone to this. This one eats more. This one eats too much. You're going to have to back them off of how much they're consuming. And a shepherd would know his individual sheep and even know them by name. So at the end of the day, he can kind of bring them back into safety and give an account for, okay, we're all here. So this is the central mandate, that the heart of a shepherd, the heart of a pastor is, I want to be around my people. I want to know them. I want to care for them. I want to protect them from certain things. And so this is obviously very different than the board elders that a lot of churches have today, where they're just, you know, these are the best businessmen. So we just pick them because obviously they're successful in business. So who wouldn't want those ringers on their squad? You know, and they come in and they don't really know the people and they don't really know what's going on in the church, and they make decisions that are binding on everybody else, and boom, you got a board elder. And I just think the picture that Peter gives us, because it's the picture that Jesus gives us of who an elder is and what they're called to do, is so radically different than just that corporate, sterile decision maker. That again, at the heart of this is an active shepherding, overseeing, example-setting kind of person. Okay, so that's the mandate. Now, a lot of this next section, he's going to kind of park on the manner. Now, if this person is doing this kind of shepherding, guiding, guarding, leading, feeding, nourishing, how, that's what I mean, manner, how is he supposed to do that? And you've got three phrases here that he kind of piles one on top of the other where he says, not like this, but like this. And actually the negative helps clarify what each of these positives mean. So the first of these, he says, not under compulsion, but willingly. And I know when I first read that, I think, why would anybody get in the pastorate under compulsion? I mean, it can be hard work a lot of the time. So this idea of doing something under compulsion, it's the word obligation. It's basically the idea of I'm doing this because I'm supposed to do it. And I could actually think of many scenarios why a person would do that. Maybe you're a fourth generation PK and your parents from the moment of your birth, you know, they've dedicated you to God and they even tell you, we've set you apart for ministry, just like daddy and your grandpa and your great grandfather, who was also a pastor. And I remember an older gentleman telling the story one time of, and some of you know this guy, Gordon McDonald, who used to work over at Denver Seminary and has pastored around the country. But literally, he was in Queens as a baby in a pack and play in the backyard, and two bombers collided over his neighborhood, and all this debris fell, including in his backyard. And there's burning wreckage in his backyard. His mom runs out, rescues him from all this burning wreckage, and is like, you're going to be a minister of the gospel. And he's like, and when you're a PK and you hear that story your entire life growing up, guess what you're going to do? Now, he also, you know, to his credit, he was not ministering under obligation. He wanted to be a pastor. But it could be something where you've heard a story over and over again of like, we set you apart. This is what you're supposed to do. Or even I see it sometimes where someone, you know, commits to something originally feeling called and excited about it, and then you get into it, and you're like, oh, this is not at all what I thought it was, and now you're just kind of going through the motions and just kind of like checking the box. I'm doing it under, and he says, not that kind of attitude, but willingly, and the willingly word can mean what we think it means of like of your own free will, like I'm choosing to do this. I want to do this. I believe God has led me to do this, and I'm excited to do this. But the word willingly can also mean purposefully, intentionally, deliberately, even strategically. Like even as I'm eager to do this, I'm willing to do this, I'm being thoughtful and intentional about the manner of doing this. So you know, I think the easy example is some of you right now, you're parenting out of obligation because you have little people in your house, right? And it's not, you wouldn't say, I am willing and eager to spend time with my kids and disciple my kids. You're just like, there are little people in my house. Somebody's got to do it. And he's saying, don't get into the ministry and don't stay into the ministry if that's your attitude toward the church of, I got all these people around. Somebody's got to lead them. Somebody's got to tell them something. He's like, do this with a joy in your heart. Now, listen, the next phrase, continuing with the manner, he says, not for shameful gain, but eagerly. And when he's talking about people who get into the ministry, apparently even at this time, because he's warning against it, because they think this is a path of ease. This is a path of maybe a financial prosperity, a way of gaining money, of gaining some kind of positive notoriety, of fame, of people will like me, they'll look up to me. And what he's warning against here is he's saying, if you're about to use serving the family of Jesus as a means of self-promotion, just don't do it. Don't get into it. You know, if you have an attitude of like, pay me what I feel like I'm worth, or I'm going to take my talents somewhere else, then don't do it. You know, Jesus had a word for that kind of person. He called them a hireling. He said, if you're a mercenary who only works for material reward, and the moment you're not paid, you're gone, he says, you're a mercenary. You don't have the heart of a shepherd and I'll just commend Richard in front of all of you. There were a number of years ago, I don't know if you know, many of you are newer, he was part-time paid staff, and we were looking at our total budget one year and saying, we really can't make everything fit. And he said, well, I love doing what I'm doing, and I would almost rather do it without any pay and just volunteer my time and volunteer a unique gifting that God has given me than to get paid for it. I think that is what God is commending here, as like, that's the attitude of a real shepherd. I'm eager to do this. I'm excited to do this. And if you can pay me, I mean, great. If you can pay me something that's fair, awesome. But I'm not working for the gain. I'm not working for the pay. This is someone who sees the intrinsic value of the work that they're doing, of the lives that they're entrusted to care for. And it's not about the money. I was looking at this just because with the start of football season, and sorry, you'll probably be hearing a few football analogies going forward through, you know, next January or something. But I really think there's something to this about the Tom Brady attitude, okay? Tom Brady is, like, by almost every statistical measure, the greatest quarterback who's ever played in the NFL. He, this year, 2019, is the 20th highest paid quarterback, okay? Kirk Cousins is paid more than him. Jimmy Garoppolo, who was his backup for the Patriots and never played, gets paid more than him. I mean, guys that you've never heard of get paid more than him. Why? Because every couple years, Tom Brady, and by the way, Tom Brady gets paid very well. He gets $20 million a year. He's not suffering. But every so many years, he literally sits down with his team and renegotiates his own contract and gives more money back into the team. You know why? Because he says, what's more valuable to me than just being the max paid quarterback is I want to win. The objective is to win. The mission is to win. And by the way, he's won a lot of Super Bowls with that kind of attitude. I'll put more money back into the pool so we can get more talent around me. And that's a little bit of the attitude of a pastor of I'm looking beyond just like what can I get to what is the actual objective here? I mean, the actual objective is not to be the highest paid person in the room or to get the praise of men or to get any number of things that I could get by having this role and serving in this role and being really good at it. The objective is to ultimately honor and glorify Jesus Christ, the chief shepherd. And that's what I want to do. Eagerly, so he's flipping it around then, not just for financial gain or for personal praise, the applause of people, recognition, that sort of thing. But he says, but eagerly. Eagerly, literally, it translates a word that's of a ready mind. Someone who's ready, someone who's prepared, who's eager to serve. It's also interesting. There's a little resource you can use in Greek or Hebrew, the two main languages that the Bible is written in. And you can look up a word and you can actually see outside of biblical literature, how were other people using that word at that same time? And so you can see this is Koine Greek that he's writing this in. And you can see there are all these other secular writers that are using the same word eagerly. And what's interesting is the way they used that word is it was the word that described how a city's benefactor invested his own time and money into his city for the betterment of other people. Okay, so a benefactor is like, you know, I'm donating art or I'm donating money so that there's the level of kind of everyone's life is lifted up. Maybe I'm paving roads for people so that the marketplace is more open to outside trade, which helps other people to do better. So they had these things called benefactors, very wealthy landowners, business owners. And it's interesting to me that word is literally, this is a person who's investing back into his own city, giving eagerly of his time because he realizes if everyone else around me is doing better, I mean, it may even have been a selfish motive. I'm going to do better. Everybody's going to do better. And this is going to be a good thing. And so his idea here is kind of instead of seeking what's best for you in that role and leveraging other people to promote yourself and to gain from the role, I mean, the word eagerly could literally mean I'm eager to invest in others so that they are lifted up. Now, the third manner, the third kind of parallel statement, he says, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. Now, first, what domineering doesn't mean? Domineering doesn't mean that someone has a strong personality. If you read, most of the New Testament was written by a guy named Paul. And you can read in the book of Acts, and you can read in his letters, Paul clearly had a very strong personality. It's not saying you have a strong personality. It's not saying that you have a high IQ, and you make other people feel small because you're so smart. Or it doesn't even mean that you're authoritative. Because the Bible calls leaders to lead, to exercise authority. Okay? Domineering refers to a proud and a self-assertive, a self-serving assertion of authority. Okay, so some examples. A domineering leader tends not to take advice. They tend not to listen to other ideas. They walk into every meeting and they're like, this is the way we're going to do it. And someone else might be like, well, hold on, I have an idea. And it's like, shut up. Okay, hey, this is more complicated than this. This is a little more nuanced than this. Domineering leaders don't like nuance. They don't like ambiguity or something being subjective. Everything's just kind of black and white. A domineering leader does not ever apologize. A domineering leader leads by force. Like, you will do this, rather than by persuasion of like, do you see the value of living this way? Do you see God's call to live this way? Do you see the, you know, we're going to come to this later in this text this morning. Do you see the rewards that are promised to you in the gospel as you live this way? I've seen domineering leaders who threaten, I've got to get my way. You're going to do what I want, or I'm going to hold something hostage. And then they kind of pout or just leave if they can't get their way. And they just go do it to the next group or the next church. It's a controlling thing. It's a, I always have to have the last word. It's a, I don't delegate this little area of ministry to other people because no one else could possibly do it as well as I do it. So these are kind of all signs of domineering. What's the flip side of this? He says not domineering, but being an example. It's a word that means to mimic or to imitate. This is where the Apostle Paul, again, with a very strong personality, but he says in 1 Corinthians 11:1, imitate me as I imitate Christ. And I think that's the right picture. And I often give you the picture of just kind of like the moving sidewalk in the airport, that we're all getting on at some point to follow Christ. And there are probably people ahead of us that have more years of walking with the Lord, more years of understanding and kind of wrestling with texts of Scripture, wrestling with suffering, wrestling with their own doubts and questions that we all have. And then other people are coming along behind you, and this picture of being an example is just, I'm going to follow Christ with a clear understanding in my mind, there are people following me. And they're not only looking to Jesus, and you know, because Jesus is in heaven, sometimes he's hard to understand, but they're looking at me as well. Like, what does the life lived for Christ look like? And obviously he's saying there's a humble, there's a gracious way to do this, that in addition, pastors, elders, I'm talking to you, in addition to the like the formal like preaching time or the teaching that you do in small groups or the teaching that you do deliberately, one-on-one counseling another friend that's struggling with something or just encouraging, you live with an understanding of my attitudes, my tone, my actions, my reactions, the things that I don't say are all saying something about what I believe the Bible says, about what we should be focused on. Okay, so kind of summarizing those three things, he's saying the manner is that you have not only biblically qualified people who are leading you, but the manner is like, I'm excited to do this. I'm eager to do this. Not that I'm excited about every meeting, not that I'm excited about every single day of work. Like, we still have seasons and we go through times and hard conversations, but the general tone is I'm eager, I'm generous, I'm committed, and I'm setting an example that if other people were to do as I do, not as just I say, on the whole, they would be walking with Christ as well. Now, why do we do this? Verse 4, we come back to the motive, where he says, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Now, I don't think he's intending this as a fear motive. Like, hey, Jesus is coming back, and he's coming with a rod, and you, pastor, if you don't do a good job at this, he's just ready to, you know, and I think what he's doing here is he's saying your motivation, first of all, is it's about identifying with Christ, it's about doing the work of Christ, and it's about receiving the reward from Christ. So I look at this text, and I think, why does he bring up the chief shepherd language here? Like, why not just say, and one day Jesus will return and da-da-da? Now, why does he say chief shepherd? Because I think that he is intentionally reminding pastors, elders, teachers, you have identified with Christ in his work. And remember that what you're called to do is the very thing that Jesus himself does for his church. And Jesus is doing it as the chief shepherd, like capital S, shepherd. But how does God care for the church? I mean, let's just be practical. How does God nourish the spiritual lives of the church on earth? How does he guard them? How does he protect them? How does he lead them to something that's healthy away from something that's unhealthy? I mean, yes, he has the word of God. Yes, he has the spirit of God at work in you. But doesn't he appoint human under shepherds, little s, to say, you are the source, you are the channel of this shepherding work, this guiding, this guarding, this nourishing? And so one of the first motives that I see Peter giving to pastors here is you have an opportunity to identify with the lead shepherd of the world in his care for his people. So do his work, and do it, notice, for a reward. By the way, I'm gonna come back to this for a moment. Elders, if you try to derive your sense of self-worth, your sense of value, your sense of identity, your sense of like, okay, I'm good. If you try to derive that from the people you lead, that is not a wise idea. Because when they're for you, you'll be like, okay, wow, now I know I'm something. I'm a good pastor. And there'll be times that you're doing the right thing and they're against you, and you might be like, oh, I'm devastated. I must have done the wrong thing, or I'm not good at this. I stink. Sorry, God, I guess I chose the wrong role. And what he's telling pastors here is you derive your identity, your worth, your mission from the shepherd. And when you derive those things from him and it's reflected back toward him, you're going to lead with the right motive. And he's saying now, do Christ's work and seek his reward. Rather than clamoring after the praise of the people you lead. I mean, it's a weird picture, right? But we get it all the time in culture. But a shepherd, I mean, it's a pretty thankless job. The sheep are not coming up. And like, I don't know if there's like a secret handshake or a special nod, because a baa that just says this. But like, hey, I'm so grateful for you. You're doing a good job right now. And I think that's part of what he's saying is, shepherd, if you're trying to derive your identity and being like, okay, I'm good. Like, sheep are just kind of thankless. They just kind of take their meal. They wander off and have no idea that they've wandered off. And you go and rescue them, and they're like, okay, I think there's probably something there. We're like, okay, at least I knew he'd come for me or something. But there's not a humility of like, wow, I put myself in a really bad spot, and you cared enough about me to come for me kind of thing. So you've got to be working for Christ's reward rather than the praise of the people that you lead, or you're not going to be a good leader. But I think with that in mind, he says, go ahead and seek that unfading crown of glory. Hebrews 13:17 says it like this. He says, your leaders are keeping watch over your souls as those who will have to give an account. Now, Hebrews sounds a little bit more negative, like, oh no, like you got to give an extra layer of account to God for how you led other people. Yeah, you do. And that could be bad, or that could be very positive. Peter's sounds positive. He's basically saying, pastors, elders, love the flock and lead them well and serve them and serve them and serve them. And when the chief shepherd appears, he'll reward you with a special reward. And if that's sounding like off to somebody, you're like, wait, so you're working for the promise of extra reward? Absolutely. Absolutely. You're like, how does that square with the gospel? Well, how does it square with the gospel? I mean, how many of you think the biblical contrast is between working for a reward and working for no reward? It's not, is it? The biblical contrast is whose reward, what kind of reward are you working for? Are you working for an earthly, temporal, praise of men kind of reward, or are you working for an eternal, unfading, imperishable reward of the God who called you and equipped you to do the ministry in the first place? I mean, Jesus himself does not say in the Sermon on the Mount, he does not say, do not lay up treasures for yourselves, period, you bunch of morons. He doesn't say, don't lay up treasures. You selfish people. What does he say? He says, don't lay up treasures here, where moth and rust corrupt, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust cannot corrupt and thieves cannot break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. He's saying, throw the treasure there. Throw the treasure there. Throw the treasure there. Put it there. Work for it there. He's not saying don't work for it. He's saying don't seek it in people. Don't seek it in this life, in this world, in just simple pleasures that pass away. So coming back to the motivation here, what if a pastor is looking forward to the return of the chief shepherd and saying, I'm excited, Lord. I know that you could come back at any moment, and there's a reward for how I carry out the care of your people that you've entrusted to me, and I'm going into this counseling situation. It's going to be really hard. I'm going to be tempted not to say the truth. I'm going to be tempted to say the truth, but I'm kind of angry because they're ignoring me, and I'm going to come in with a certain attitude. Or I got to preach this sermon, and it's not my favorite text. Or I got to preach this sermon, and it is my favorite text, and so I'm going to really shine this morning. You know, it's going to be awesome, and people are just going to be like, that was incredible. And see, all these things that you go into as a pastor, as an elder, as a leader, if the motivation is my chief shepherd could return at any moment with his reward, I just think of it like this. If I'm teaching a new members class or preaching a sermon or going to a counseling session and the chief shepherd appears, I want him to be able to lay, like, just put his hand on my shoulder and be like, good job. I'll take it from here. And just be able to finish the sentence, because I've been already hopefully pointing people in that right direction. So yeah, I'm working for an unfading prize reward. Elders, you should be too. Because I hear Jesus saying something like, you have shared in my mission under my authority, caring for my people, and now you get to share in my glory forever. And I think in heaven, you'll probably be able to look around and be like, to God be all the praise and glory. But it's cool to see you and you and you. I remember you guys from down there when God had for a brief time entrusted you to our care. Is this antithetical to the gospel? No. So the gospel says you are saved by grace alone. The picture of the Bible is you're dead, I'm dead in our sin. There's nothing that we can do for Christ. We're dead. And he comes, and by a free gift of his grace, he makes us alive. He unites us with Christ. He identifies with Christ. He gives us the death and the burial and the resurrection that Jesus went through on our behalf. And Jesus says, now with this new life, with this new identity, now live for me. And the works that we do then in obedience to God, in trying to glorify God in our life, those works are not meritorious. They are not working our way to heaven. They're not salvific, to use that fancy word that means those works do not save us. But the works are important. They matter. Okay? So yes, saved by grace. But now that we are saved, how do we labor? Why do we labor? And part of it is, you know, if it's between working for an earthly reward that I can't take with me and working for a heavenly reward of maybe even literally looking around and being like, you're here. Like, I had something to do with you being here by God's grace. So to him be the glory, okay? I want to encourage you, elders. I know, and I know you know, some days and seasons are really hard at this job. And it may seem like there are no benefits to this. Like, it just seems like sometimes, like, everybody's mad at me, and if I check my email right now, I know the only emails I'm going to have are negative ones, so I'm not going to check my email. I'm going to go fishing. And I think it's part of why a lot of pastors, like some of these guys, they burn out, or they're just like, I'm not seeing the reward. I'm not seeing the payback. I'm not getting the feels that I thought I would be getting for serving God in a uniquely difficult task. So I guess I'll have an affair. That'll be fun. Guys, this motivation is, if you seek the chief shepherd and you're like, I'm living for you, and you can even say, and I'm really down right now, I'm really discouraged, this is a tough season of ministry, but I want to keep investing in the things that you say matter forever. Help me do that. Now, point 4 and 5 quickly, because these are similar. Number 4, mutuality. This is verse 5 where he turns now and says, likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. Likewise. Why likewise? Because what he's just gotten done saying is a godly leader is not like, how can I use this as a platform for self-promotion? A godly leader is, how can I use this as a platform for loving and serving and caring for other people, listening to them, observing their needs, investing in their lives, being the benefactor of that city, by giving away my money and my time so that other people's lives are improved. So you see the likewise? He's saying, in the same way that even those who lead you are not thinking about themselves but are thinking about you, so you also now, and be subject is the same word that we use back in 2:13, 2:18, and 3:1, where back there he's saying, you know, arrange yourself under the governing officials that God has given to you. Arrange yourself under your master or your boss. You know, wives, in a certain way, arrange yourself under your husband. And it's not an inferiority. Like, if you're on top, you're the superior. If you're on the bottom, you're the inferior. Because again, I'll point out, this same word is used of Jesus' relationship to his earthly parents, Mary and Joseph. Okay? Eternal God arranging himself under earthly broken people to show them respect, to show them proper honor. And that's all this word means. It means it's a respectful submission or an inclination to follow and support. Now, there are times where you may say, I can't support that decision because it goes against the authority of God's word. Well, good for you. That's part of what a godly leader would want, is for you to be on the lookout for, hey, something seems a little off about that. Something smells funny about that. Can we have a conversation? I mean, again, this is where Hebrews 13, 17, now giving you the whole verse, says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. You know what he's saying? This is super practical. He's saying, it's not very much fun to lead ornery people. Just like if you're a shepherd and you got that ornery sheep, that's just like you're leading and you're nourishing, and that one sheep is always like, I think I'll go check out these thistles over here and wander off over here. Like, that's tough if you're always going after the one, or the one that's, you know, sheep bite their shepherds. They attack and bite their shepherds. And there's that one sheep that's like always biting, and it's not a joy to lead that sheep that's always biting, okay? It's just not. And I'll tell you practically who is a joy to lead, okay? So they're extremes. You have like the person who's always pushing against everything that you say. They just automatically assume you're wrong, you're doing this for yourself, I'm pushing back. It's not a joy to lead that person. But you know who else is not that much of a joy to lead? Is like the Stepford sheep that are just like, oh, I know what I'm supposed to do. It's just like you just fall in the line and you just kind of like just keep your nose down and you're quiet and don't say anything, and just whatever he says, just say, yes, okay, absolutely, jump, how high, okay. It's not that much joy to lead that, like, yes type person either. What's a joy is when you have people who are like, as you are investing in us, we want to invest in one another and in this relationship with you. So as we're doing church life together, flock life together, I have a thoughtful question, and I want to be respectful about this, but have you thought about this? Or, you know, I think I may actually disagree with that. I'm not going to make a big public fight over that, but can we grab coffee and talk about that? And then that person is also like, hey, that was great. I thank you. I support you in that. But that kind of healthy disagreement at times, that kind of I've got a different perspective, I have a different opinion, leads to the most productive and healthy kind of pastor-church relationship or inner church relationships, okay? So that's the mutuality, is simply that idea of the respectful submission or inclination to follow and support. And now the mindset, and I close with, I added verse 6 because he's still talking about the same thing. He's just talking about humility. He's saying, all of you now, okay? So first I addressed elders, then I addressed the congregation, but now I'm saying, all of you, clothe yourself with humility toward one another, for God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Okay, and it's an interesting word picture of humility being like a garment, a beautiful garment, a robe that you could put on, because a person who's clothed only with self is still naked. Okay, think about that. If you're just like, my garment is me, and I'm putting on me, and life's about me, then in a sense, you're still exposed. But humble people are humble because they've clothed themselves with humility. And there's a reciprocity here, because he's saying, be humble toward one another. Now, humility, you know, what is that? Well, I mean, it literally means a low mind. But I think Tim Keller says it well when he says, the essence of humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. The essence of humility is not like, oh, woe is me, just a, you know, false humility is the worst kind of pride. It just really is. I mean, you deal with people who know they're proud and they're just proud, and you can least deal with them. But the person that false humility of just groveling and self-criticism and I'm just a worm and scum of the earth, that's not humility. Humility is just I'm focused on Christ here and I'm focused on other people. And I don't think that much about myself except what gifts God has given me, what resources God has given me to invest in other people. By the way, you know who's consistently the happiest and most satisfied people in church life? They're people who are actively serving other people, okay? And it's counterintuitive, but I see people who are like, well, I have very limited time. I'm super busy. So, if I'm here at all, you're lucky to see me. And I just never see those people being that joyful or that Christ-like. And I know other people that are 10 times busier than that person, and they're still some of the first to be like, hey, there's a need. Somebody was in an accident. Somebody had a baby prematurely. Somebody needs counsel from the Word. I want to be there. I want to make myself available to love and to help other people, not to build me up, but to build them up. And I see consistently those are the happiest, most satisfied people in church life. It's people who just bring their gifts to God and say, use me how you want. I'm in. And here's the really counterintuitive principle of the gospel that he ends on here. Is the world says the way up is up. You want to go up. You want to be exalted. You want to be lifted up. You want to be recognized. The way up, then climb the ladder. Put down other people. Make sure that you're don't waste time on church people. I mean, you got meetings to do that are important where you could climb this thing and you could get above other people and then you'd be really cool and you'd probably get a raise to boot. That's what the world does. And do you see what he says here in this last verse that I read? Verse 6, he says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you. And what you're doing when you're humble and you're putting God first and you're putting other people ahead of yourself, you're saying, I trust the mighty hand of God to lift me up more than I trust my own resources and wisdom. And so the countercultural mindset that we're all called to, elders toward congregation, congregation toward elders, all of us toward one another, is, and Jesus says, and Peter says, in the Christian life, the way up is down. The one who goes up is the one who is the servant of all. You know, and I could stand up here and list, like, not countless people, because we don't have countless people, but a number of you who would say, oh, there's a need in the nursery again. Like, I really wanted to, you know, I wanted to hear the sermon. I wanted to be fed this morning, but there's a need, and I'm just going to jump in and love and serve. And, oh, here's an outreach opportunity. I'm going to be there because I want to see God do something. And there's this prayer night, and I don't know who's going to come, but I believe that I've got to depend on the Lord to do something for the rest of my church and for me, and I'm going to be there. And what that person is doing is saying, I will go down and just entrust my life to God to lift me up in his time. So let's come full circle on this. Healthy church life is all about the chief shepherd. And that's why Peter brings him up here. And basically what he's saying is we have this short blip of time between the past sufferings of Christ. This is where Peter starts in 5:1. You have the past sufferings of Christ, and elders and pastors, teachers, you're sitting there and you're saying, how do the sufferings of Jesus inform what we're doing today, what we're all about today, our attitudes, our mindset today? And at the same time, we're doing what Peter did, and we're saying, I'm looking back to that, and I'm letting that inform me and how I lead a congregation, but I'm also looking forward because there's a future glory that's going to be awesome. Just talking to the Matt Noka this morning. They just came back from Paris and other places, and he was telling his kids, like, looking at a beautiful man-made cathedral. Look at the stained glass. That's incredible. I mean, just feel the weight of this building and the arches and the stone and the glass and the wood carvings. Like, isn't it incredible? And if you've seen some of these cathedrals in some major cities, they're unbelievable. And he's like, if people can build that, how much more glorious do you think that eternal glory is going to be in a city that God is building? It's going to be incredible. And he's saying, so pastors are always looking back saying, how do the sufferings of Christ relate to what I'm doing today? How does that future glory relate to what I'm doing today? But in either case, in both cases, it's about the chief shepherd and the work that he's up to in your lives and making much about him. And so I just leave you with this. Here's Peter's picture of the church, which if a community like this truly exists, in the cities of mankind, it's going to be a completely alternate city within the city, because he says the church community is humble people leading other humble people to see and savor Jesus Christ. Okay, so if God has given you any position of leadership, or if you aspire to that, and God says it's a good thing to aspire to that, the church is just humble people leading other humble people to see and savor the lead shepherd, Jesus. Let's make much of him.